So, no.
I think we've got to think extremely hard about it. I think modern warfare is completely different to how it was before. And, you know, we've been there for 20 years, and I think there have definitely been improvements for the Afghan people. But at the end of the day, you know, there's certain societies that you can't change in that sense. I would think very hard about that.
We should help them because it's like an ally, but not as much as what we've probably done for this one. Like, hold back a bit of what we've put out and all the efforts we've made for this one.
Depends on the individual circumstances of what's going on at the time, you know. If it's something that needs our support, then we should give it. If it's something that we think that we should spend a bit more time thinking about our response, then we should do that as well. But you can't just blanketly say, if America calls us up, should we go or not? Because that's amateurish as well, you know?
No, I think we should just, you know, if it's our war and they want to help, good. And if we really needed to save people, fine. But if it's just, you know, a minor thing that they've caused for no particular reason, just because they want to, then why should we put our men and women in danger to help them when they've done it to themselves?
Dominic Raab has faced embarrassing and some would say humiliating accusations of being unaware and absent without leave during the chaotic evacuation of UK forces and personnel from Afghanistan. He has been unable to explain why, when the American plan to withdraw had been announced in February 2020, there was still no proper plan for a British withdrawal a year and a half later. Many believe that the Afghanistan disaster isn't just a failure of British foreign policy, but that it's also evidence the UK can no longer command the respect of the world when it comes to matters of military action. In 1940, during World War II, Britain turned an urgent retreat in Dunkirk into a moral victory. Now, in 2021, the chaotic and incompetent evacuation of Afghanistan delivered the opposite message, and revealed a British government and a British Foreign Secretary looking out of options, out of touch, and out of control.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. the limelight. French anger at Scott Morrison government's decision to scrap its $90 billion Australian dollar submarine program, which France continues to boil over, with the country's recalled ambassador saying it felt fooled by the announcement. We now present you an article written jointly by Dan Sabat, Julian Borger and Heather Stewart. The piece is titled UK-France Defence Summit Cancelled in AUKUS Row. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Franco-British Defence Minister's summit, due to take place in the coming days, has been cancelled as Paris steps up its protests over the loss of a £48 billion submarine contract with Australia and its secret replacement with nuclear technology from Britain and United States. Ben Wallace, Britain's Defence Secretary, and his opposite number, Florence Parly, had been due to hold a bilateral meeting in London and to address the two-day Franco-British Council, now the latest casualties of the diplomatic row. The Franco-British Council was also due to be attended by defence chiefs from both countries. The co-chair, Peter Ricketts, a former UK National Security Advisor, confirmed the elite gathering had been postponed to a later date. Without the event going ahead, it is understood that the French Defence Minister Florence Parly's planned trip to London is deemed to have become redundant. Earlier on Sunday, 19th of September, British sources said they had hoped the meetings would proceed, listing joint counter-terror operations such as in Mali and in Iraq as examples of the relationship between the two. One said, "We have a strong and close working defence partnership with the French as trusted allies." But Paris is incensed after Australia abandoned a lucrative but troubled contract for new diesel submarines with a French contractor to switch to a nuclear-powered alternative after 6 months of secret negotiations with Britain and the United States. France recalled its ambassadors to the United States and Australia over the weekend, plunging relationships between the countries to an almost unheard-of low. The cancellation of the defence summit demonstrates there will also be repercussions for Britain, which could yet deepen as the row continues. Concern about the French reaction also prompted US President Joe Biden to ask to talk to his French opposite number, President Emmanuel Macron, in an attempt to ease the dispute. The French government spokesperson, Gabriel Attal, said President Biden asked to speak to President Macron, and there will be a telephone discussion in the next few days between President Macron and President Biden. The escalating row also threatens to overshadow a trip to the United States by Boris Johnson and his newly promoted Foreign Secretary Liz Truss. Both will visit the United Nations General Assembly in New York, while Boris Johnson is expected to visit the White House for the first time as Prime Minister to meet President Biden. On Sunday night, 19th of September, Boris Johnson insisted our French friends should not worry about the controversial AUKUS Defence Pact, claiming our love of France is ineradicable. Boris Johnson added, "We are very, very proud of our relationship with France, and it is a huge importance to this country. It is a very friendly relationship, an entente cordiale that goes back a century or more, and it is absolutely vital for us." Although Emmanuel Macron had not been due to attend the annual World Leaders Gathering, Liz Truss will have to face his foreign minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, at a meeting of the United Nations Security Council in the coming days. Jean-Yves Le Drian, considered close to Emmanuel Macron, has been vocal in denouncing the submarine deal, describing it as a stab in the back for France and accusing those involved of engaging in duplicity, contempt and lies over the past few months. France is particularly unhappy that in bilateral and other meetings over the last few months, ministers from the three countries gave no indication on what was being planned, with some diplomatic sources saying the feeling of anger and betrayal in Paris is still being underestimated. British defense sources argued that it was left to the Australians to break the news to the French, but it seemed there were divisions in Canberra about the best way of going about this. The defence source said some Australians wanted to ring up 1 week and say, "We're so sorry, we're putting out the diesel submarine contract," and ring up the next week and say, "We just want you to know that we found a better submarine and it's British," adding, "There was another school of thought that said, don't do it like that, they'll see through it and it will be worse because it will look duplicitous." In the end, neither side won. The French were not told before details began to leak to the Australian and US media on Wednesday morning, 15th of September. The United Kingdom has argued that it was simply responding to a request from Australia to seek secret nuclear propulsion technology for its submarines in March this year, technology shared between Britain and United States under a defense agreement that dates back to 1958. The defense source said that having secured British support, the Australians then went to the Biden administration. But the claim of relative British passivity is undermined by other briefings from Downing Street, which have said that Boris Johnson was eager to widen the nuclear submarine deal into something deeper in the aftermath of Brexit. The three countries also announced AUKUS, a defence technology pact, in which they confirmed they would work together on sharing breakthroughs in areas such as artificial intelligence and quantum computing. The three said the nuclear propulsion deal was the first instance of that. Meanwhile, French anger at the Morrison government's decision to scrap its $90 billion Australian dollar submarine programme with France continues to boil over, with the country's recalled ambassador saying it felt fooled by the announcement. Jean-Pierre Fibault was ordered back to Paris in the wake of the AUKUS announcement, which will see Australia enter into strategic forever partnership with the United States and Britain. Part of the still-to-be-determined arrangement will include the sharing of nuclear-powered submarine technology with Australia, prompting the Morrison government to tear up its existing contract with France. On Sunday, 19th of September, Scott Morrison said his government had informed France's President Emmanuel Macron that the deal was off at around 8:30, the night before the deal was announced. But details had already leaked to the media, and the French have said they felt blindsided by the decision. Jean-Pierre Fibault told ABC Radio, "We discovered through the press that the most important person of this Australian government kept us in the dark intentionally until the last minute." He added, "This is not an Australian attitude towards France, and maybe we're not friends." Fibault said the French had shared their knowledge with Australia in good faith, but had been kept in the dark about Australia's discussions with the other allied nations. Jean-Pierre Fibault said this was a plot in the making for 18 months. At the same time, while we were engaged with making the best of this submarine program, where France committed its most well-kept military secrets, there was a complete other project that we discovered, thanks to the press, just 1 hour before the announcement. So you can imagine our anger. We felt fooled. Australia's Trade Minister, Dan Tehan, will touch down in Paris for a meeting with his French counterpart in early October to discuss Australia's hopes for a free trade agreement with the European Union. Fibault said, At this stage, she expected the negotiations to continue, although after the AUKUS announcement, France asked its fellow European Union member states to reconsider including Australia in any free trade agreement. So far, the two issues are being kept separate. Tehan said he saw no reason the 12th round of talks would not continue as planned. He told the ABC, "My hope is we will be able to, over the next 12 to 18 months, finalise this agreement." Labour's Penny Wong said the Scott Morrison government had mishandled its relationship with an ally in how it balanced the AUKUS announcement with the French contract and had failed to minimise the effect on Australia's national interest. Penny Wong added, "It is not in our national interest to make our friends so angry and so disappointed. The French would be asking, with friends like this, who needs enemies?"
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
On August 15th, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau dissolved the Parliament and called a snap election. Now, Canadians are preparing to cast their ballot in the 2021 federal election on September 20th to elect members of the 44th Canadian Parliament. Polls show that the Liberal Party, led by the current Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and the Conservatives, led by leader Erin O'Toole, are neck and neck in the race, as they are both predicted to win 32% of the national popular vote. Therefore, it is a type of election where Canadian Muslim voter groups can make a difference, as they account for 3.2% of the country's population. Muslims are mainly concerned about Islamophobia. Canada has suffered from more mass killings motivated by Islamophobia in the last 5 years than any other country in the G7. Since 2017, 11 Canadian Muslims have been killed in three deadly attacks driven by Islamophobia. The 2017 Quebec City mosque mass killing is one example, which has been the worst anti-Muslim mass murder incident in Canadian history.
Well, it's certainly out of character for most Canadians, but there is a right-wing segment of Canadian society that has gained legitimacy from the actions and words of U.S. President Donald Trump. So the Conservative Party has generally been sort of very pro-Israeli, anti-Muslim, and anti-Palestinian, and has attacked people who have expressed support for the Palestinians, claiming that they're somehow anti-Semitic.
Islamophobia is a problem deeply rooted in Canada's social and political fabric. Experts believe that the federal leaders lack what is needed to fully address the rise of hatred and systematic discrimination in this country. According to one victim, the political leadership is responsible for allowing this polarization to take place, and the years of public discourse have created this anti-Muslim hate. The Liberal Party of Canada has vowed to create a national support fund to help survivors of hate crimes. It also wants to update the federal anti-racism strategy by 2022 and approve new legislation to combat this spread of online hate. Meanwhile, the New Democratic Party and the Conservative Party have promised to tackle online hate as well. However, there is no mention of Islamophobia or racism in the major political party's entire platform. During their campaign trail, none of the Canadian major political parties held public events to address racism and Islamophobia. Also, despite all having platform planks on the issue, when questioned, none of them explained why they haven't done that.
Trudeau was always balanced and kept a Canada independent policy. His son Justin actually has been very fair and supportive of the Muslim community, even though he has been attacked by right-wing members of the politics and also in the media. So he has actually taken some flack for taking stance in support of the Muslim community, but he has not been able to make the change for Israel, where he's still anti-Palestinian and still very much beholden to the pro-Zionist lobby in Canada.
Canadian Muslims urged their leaders to take measures to combat Islamophobia, as it has resulted in deadly attacks and rising anti-Muslim hatred. However, Canadian politicians have for years failed to do so, since they see Muslims as only potential vote-getting opportunities that belong on their platforms.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, has approved documents for Iran's full membership at the Eurasian Political, Economic, and Security Alliance. The decision came as the 21st summit of the organization opened in Dushanbe earlier in the day. The Islamic Republic joined the SCO in 2005 as an observer state.
SCO, with the current membership, covers close to 50% of the world population and about one-third of the world's GDP. Being a member of this organization will take a lot of pressure away in terms of Western sanctions, Western impositions, monetary manipulations via the US dollar as a remedy for payment. No more.
Leaders from 8 member states and 4 observer states attended the annual summit in Tajikistan's capital on Friday, with the Chinese leader Xi Jinping addressing it virtually along with Russian president. Xi criticized sanctions imposed on world economic exchanges, urging the SCO members to stay united against attacks by other countries. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his counterpart from Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Belarus, Pakistan, Turkmenistan, and Uzbekistan attended in person. Addressing the summit, President Raisi said the world today has entered a new era when hegemony and unilateralism are declining.
The world is entering a new era but a new order. Domination and unilateralism are on the decline. International order is moving toward multipolarization and redistribution of power in favor of independent states.
The Iranian president also underlined that sanctions are preventing regional cooperation and urged the SCO to define mechanisms to fight these challenges. In his address at the SCO summit, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi described sanctions as economic terrorism and the hegemonic power's most important tool to impose their own will on the others. He warned that unilateral sanctions are not limited to one country, but as it has become clear in recent years, they include more independent countries, particularly the SCO member states. 2 key members of the alliance, Russia and China, have also come under sanctions from the West. Ties between Washington and Beijing deteriorated after former U.S. President Donald Trump took office in 2017, waging an economic war against China. While many expected the current administration of Joe Biden to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies, it adopted a tougher stance against China and Russia, imposing several rounds of sanctions on them on various pretexts.
Western trade currency restrictions do not exist in the SCO member countries. This will drastically reduce the potential for Western sanctions and will increase, on the other hand, Iran's potential to deal with the East, for example, or especially China and Russia, entering partnership agreements with these and other SCO countries, benefiting from comparative advantages.
At the end of the summit, SCO member states signed the Dushanbe Declaration, in which they stress opposition to interference under the excuse of counterterrorism or human rights,
or solving key international and regional issues through small cliques, ideology, or confrontation mentality. They also agreed on strengthening cooperation in cracking down on terrorism, extremism, and separatism, and reached a consensus in supporting building an inclusive government in Afghanistan.
The Israel regime has reportedly started a cyber sabotage campaign in the UAE to interfere with the regional air and maritime navigation in West Asia.
Cyber warfare is becoming more and more important and more dangerous as well. So Israel wants to take advantage of any opportunities there.
The campaign seeks to disrupt the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman region's air and maritime navigation systems, thus destabilizing the regional security situation. On the other hand, the bid seeks to transit the focal point of crisis away from the occupied territories towards the region and therefore reduce the political and security pressure faced by the regime's ruling body. The UAE has signed dozens of memorandums of understanding with Israel since it became the first Arab state to normalize ties with Israel this century.
Israel sees itself with the Sunni monarchies and the conservatives as their potential allies in this. So it wants to be able to conduct the kind of cyber sabotage and infiltration that is becoming so important, so much more important. So it's not surprising that they would do this when they have the opportunity, and the UAE is providing that opportunity for them.
Israel has said that it expects $1 billion in trade with the UAE by the end of 2021, and $3 billion in 3 years. The UAE aims to raise the value of economic activity with Israel to more than $1 trillion in the next 10 years. According to regional observers, at the heart of the UAE's desire to normalize ties with the regime in Tel Aviv was its penchant for U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets, which the peace deals with Israel, known as the Abraham Accords, made possible. After the Persian Gulf state established full diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime in a deal brokered by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. Shortly after the deal was reached, the Trump administration authorized the sale of 50 advanced F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. The UAE and Israel are reportedly deepening their ties and espionage activities in the region. The UAE has helped Israel set up a center for military and maritime reconnaissance on the strategic Yemeni island of Socotra. The Red Crescent Society of the United Arab Emirates has signed a contract with the Tel Aviv regime in order to create an intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at Socotra Airport. Socotra is home to some 60,000 people. It overlooks the Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route that connects the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. It also has a unique ecosystem, which is already being exploited by the Emiratis. The mission reportedly aimed at collecting information from across the Gulf of Aden, including Bab el-Mandab and south of Yemen, which is under the control of forces backed by the UAE. Socotra has been a source of tensions between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. They have been jockeying for position for control of the island's unique resources in the absence of a powerful government in Yemen amid a ferocious war in the country. Back in June 2020, UAE-backed separatists of the so-called Southern Transitional Council, or the STC, took control of Socotra.
As you know, Israel has always welcomed the opportunity to have alliances within what it has considered to be the enemy camp, namely the Arabs. In the opportunity with an alliance is to profit in various ways, to build one's power through espionage.
A new security pact involving the United States, Britain, and Australia has triggered controversy and condemnation. The U.S. and U.K. announced this week that they will provide Australia with advanced technology to build nuclear-powered submarines. Based on their agreement, Australian naval forces will have atomic submarines that are much faster as they use nuclear propulsion systems and harder to detect than conventional fleets. They can spend months under the sea and target longer distances with their missiles. The leaders of the three countries hailed the New Deal as a step that will make it easier to counter threats in the Indo-Pacific. They repeatedly mentioned regional security concerns, which they said had grown significantly. None of them mentioned China, but the pact is being widely viewed as an initiative to counter Chinese influence in the region, including in the contested, resource-rich South China Sea.
Well, there are two elements here. One is the fact that this alliance could be a new version of NATO for Indo-Pacific region, and the other is that this purchase of nuclear-powered submarine could be an initial step to transfer more technology to nuclear technology to Australia, maybe in the long term having Australia acquiring nuclear bomb capacity.
The United States and its allies make no secret of their intensified efforts to try to contain the growing Chinese influence and power there. Many observers believe the newly announced deal is in line with those efforts. Meanwhile, the development is expected to further sour relations between Beijing and Canberra. In recent years, political tensions have grown between the two over a number of issues, including Australia's stance against Chinese telecom giant Huawei. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Xiao Lijian criticized what he called the U.S.-led alliance's obsolete Cold War mentality and warned the three countries against moves that would hurt their own interests. Some Chinese media went so far as to say that Australia had now turned itself into an adversary of China. What are the implications of this new pact and other moves against China for regional and international security? Meanwhile, China was not the only party infuriated by the new security pact. France condemned it too. That is because Australia will now scrap a deal with France to buy a dozen conventional submarines worth tens of billions of dollars. France's Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian called Australia's agreement with the US and the UK a stab in the back. France said the development underscored the need to bolster a, quote, European strategic autonomy. The United States and arch-rival China may have toned down their rhetoric against each other, but tensions between the two superpowers are simmering as they remain deeply engaged in an intense global rivalry. There are many flashpoints in their testy relationship, including tensions in the South China Sea and the issue of Taiwan. America has made it clear that its military will maintain a strong presence in the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. has been trying to contain the growing influence of its arch-rival. America seems determined to follow policies aimed at containing the Chinese influence worldwide. And with China absolutely unwilling to back down, tensions are expected to mount in the coming years.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
U.S. military lies unnecessarily dragged on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, says Paul Antonopoulos Ryder in an article published under the heading Top U.S. Generals Blatantly Lied About Afghanistan and Iraq Wars to Advance Their Careers. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. According to the Pentagon's annual reports on military justice, there have been more than 1.3 million cases of discipline in the U.S. military since 2001, mostly relating to the so-called War on Terror. But as The Intercept highlighted, the generals who misled Congress and the American public about the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have not only avoided repercussions after conducting a disinformation campaign for 20 years, but were instead rewarded for their deceivingly positive assessments. When they retired with generous military pensions, they landed high-paying jobs on corporate boards, further profiting from their disingenuousness, Peter Moss wrote in The Intercept. Following the terrorist attacks against the U.S. on September 11, 2001, then-President George W. Bush took his country into destructive wars against Afghanistan and Iraq. What also followed the 9/11 attacks was an outpouring of ignorance, racism, and violence against supposedly Muslim-appearing Americans. This even culminated in the murder of Indian-born Balbir Singh Sodhi by 43-year-old Frank Silva Rook, who during his arrest shouted slogans like, "I am a patriot, I stand for America all the way, and I wish that my punishment would be sending me to Afghanistan with a lot of expletive weapons." Sodhi's murder is considered the first post-9/11 backlash against non-Christian America. However, Rook's actions and calls to fight in Afghanistan was not in isolation, and in fact, many Americans with similar extremism joined the military. The wars in Afghanistan and Iraq saw entire infrastructures destroyed, hundreds of thousands of civilians killed, millions of refugees, and over $6 trillion of American taxpayer money wasted. Much of this devastation was caused by American troops, often with impunity. In fact, the Americans were not alone in such war crimes, with many British, Australian, and other troops from partner countries responsible for murder, rape, extortion, and theft in Afghanistan and Iraq. What is most concerning, though, is that the upper echelons of the U.S. military had little to no concern for the war crimes perpetrated by NATO forces. Instead, they focused on creating a narrative portraying the situation in Afghanistan and Iraq as constantly improving. Journalist Craig Whitelock's new book, The Afghanistan Papers, provides evidence that military leaders knew the war in Afghanistan was failing but lied about it. Colonel Bob Crowley claims in the book that every data point was altered to present the best picture possible, and Whitelock describes the military's positive assessments as unwarranted and baseless that amounted to a disinformation campaign. The main question is why the top military leaders were adamant in their claims that the war situation in Afghanistan and Iraq was improving. It can be suggested that their lies about the situation in Afghanistan and Iraq was motivated by self-interest to advance their own careers in capital. They were certainly not going to allow the deteriorating situation in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as over 1.3 million cases of ill discipline in the military, including rape, torture, and murder, ruin their prospects. Take, for example, the current U.S. Secretary of Defense, Lloyd Austin. During the 2003 invasion of Iraq, Austin was the assistant commander of the 3rd Infantry Division. The Intercept recounts an exchange in May 2013, just weeks after the U.S. captured Baghdad, between Austin and Dr. Kashab, director of the Dora oil refinery. No matter about Kashab's insistence that Baghdad was more crime-ridden under U.S. occupation than under Saddam Hussein's rule, Austin could only say that 2 months ago was a brutal dictator who killed thousands of people. Austin, who from the very beginning of Iraq's occupation insisted everything was fine, eventually became the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq, then took charge of Central Command that covers all operations in the West Asia region, retired with $15,000 a month pension, and then joined several corporate boards, including the board of directors of United Technologies Corporation, the military contractor that merged with Raytheon in 2020. With these corporate gigs, he became a multimillionaire with a $2.6 million mansion that boasts 7 bedrooms, a 5-car garage, 2 kitchens, and a pool house in the Washington, D.C. area. Along with Austin was also David Petraeus, who at the start of the Iraq War was a major general. But as the Intercept authors recount, Petraeus was doing what pretty much every general who served in Iraq and Afghanistan would do: stringing together any data he could find that would masquerade as a narrative of success. The statistics on his PowerPoint were vintage Vietnam. Find big numbers and call them victory. In 2007, Petraeus was named the commander of U.S. forces in Iraq and hailed as a savior. He then went on to command U.S. and NATO forces in Afghanistan from 2010 to 2011. Although Petraeus assured Congress in 2011 that the situation in Afghanistan was improving, Whitelock's book notes that military officers in the field knew the blizzard of numbers meant nothing. One of Petraeus' advisors in Afghanistan, Sarah Case, recalled how she suggested ideas to stem corruption in the U.S.-backed government in Kabul but none of those plans were ever implemented. She wrote, I responded to request after request from Petraeus until I realized that he had no intention of acting on my recommendations. It was just make work. In late 2011, Petraeus then headed the CIA, but in 2012 was caught sharing highly classified information with his wife and resigned, avoiding felony charges and lengthy prison sentences that haunt the likes of Chelsea Manning and Edward Snowden. Following the CIA, Petraeus was rewarded with a lucrative partnership at the private equity giant KKR, securing his wealth in his retirement years. Effectively, the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have been allowed to drag on for the second decade because those at the very top of the U.S. military were more concerned about advancing their own careers. By doing so, the United States unleashed thousands of troops with similar thinking to Frank Silver Roque that wanted to exact revenge on those they held responsible for the 9/11 attacks, thus resulting in countless NATO war crimes against innocent civilians.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
13 days after breaking out from Gilboa Jail, Israel's maximum security prison, Ayham Kamamji and Munadal Enfi'at were rearrested by Israeli forces during a military incursion into northern city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. Kamamji and Enfi'at, both members of the Islamic Jihad movement, were the last of six Palestinian prisoners who escaped Gilboa prison on September 6. Like their fellow inmates, they were immediately taken to an unknown place for interrogation, and the Israeli authorities have extended their detention to continue the interrogation process. Palestinian Authorities Commission of Detainees Affairs held Israel responsible for their lives and said it's illegal to retry prisoners who are already serving sentences and life sentences.
Israelis are trying to cover up the scandal of the prison break. The prisoners who succeeded to flee were serving life sentences. Now, Israel's decision to extend their detention under interrogation serves only to soothe the public outrage on Israeli streets. We warn Israeli authorities against harming the prisoners, especially if they continue placing them in solitary confinement for lengthy periods after their interrogation.
The inmates were arrested after a large number of Israeli troops raided different parts of Jenin. Clashes broke out between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers in a number of locations, with stones and explosives thrown towards Israeli forces. A number of Palestinians were moderately wounded during the clashes, according to medics. Moreover, two Palestinians were arrested during the operation. The Israeli military claims they had helped Kamamji and Enfi'at hide in Jenin.
Israel boasted of a security image, but it was tarnished by the Palestinian inmates' prison break. Now, even the rearrest of the last two inmates in Jenin cannot boost the image. The prison break was a great blow for Israel.
Last weekend, Zakaria Zubaydi, Mahmoud Arda, Mohammed Qadiri, and Mohammed Arda were captured by Israeli forces in and near Nazareth, northern the occupied lands. Their lawyers said the men have been subjected to physical and mental abuse and torture by Israeli interrogators, and each of them is placed in 2-by-1-square-meter room lacking basic necessities for life.
Palestinians say Israel's security failure can never be rectified by the rearrest of the six prisoners or through the Israeli military operations across the occupied territories. They add the fact at the end of the day proves that the jailbreak has embarrassed Israel's security establishment. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The rearrest of the last two remaining Palestinian inmates who had escaped from an Israeli jail has sparked public outrage among the Palestinians. Palestinians have come together in the Gaza Strip to voice their anger at Israel's growing pressure on the Palestinian inmates.
We in the Gaza Strip stress that fight against the Israeli occupation will go on and the rearrest of the inmates won't deter us from expressing our solidarity with them. The prison break of the Palestinian inmates has inflicted a heavy blow on Israel's image. The resistance front has vowed to set them free in the coming exchange deal. We will never forget this achievement.
Reports say the two men were caught alive in Jenin, their hometown in the West Bank, after they were surrounded by Israeli army.
We have come here to condemn the inhumane Israeli treatment of our prisoners. Our message to our inmates is that we will keep supporting them until they are freed. The international community has ignored the issue of Palestinian prisoners for years.
2 weeks ago, six Palestinian inmates caved through a dug hole in the floor of their shared cell, exposing deep security flaws of the Israeli system. Palestinians held several rallies calling for ending the Israeli violation of prisoners' rights.
Palestinians will keep holding events like this to voice their support to our detainees in Israeli jails. Israeli regime should know that our prisoners are not alone and we view them as symbol of resistance. The international community should break its silence and expose the true nature of Israeli regime.
Thousands of Palestinians are held in Israeli jails, with hundreds of them under the practice of administrative detention.
Palestinians here stress the rearresting of two inmates who broke out of the Jabu prison does not hide the fragility of the Israeli security system. Palestinians see the escape as a remarkable incident in the history of the Palestinian cause, demanding the international community to stop Israel's torture against detainees. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
The serial killings of Iranian scientists must stop. This comment was made by families of the five slain nuclear scientists who were allegedly assassinated by Israeli agents. Now the households of the victims have filed a lawsuit against the U.S. for its support for Tel Aviv and what people here call terrorist activities against Iran.
I believe the reason that they did this in front of my eyes and my mother's eyes was to terrorize people. That's what terrorists do.
We have already gotten too late into this legal proceeding. They killed my husband 12 years ago, and I still feel the pain. It's not easy to forget such a great loss. The point is, America and Israel do not feel sorry for this, and that's why we ask Iranian and international judicial systems to bring the perpetrators to justice.
Iran does not recognize Israel as a country. This is why the case is not directly aimed at Israel, but is targeting the U.S. as a supporting force behind Tel Aviv. If succeeded, the move will lead to the freezing of American assets in foreign countries.
We are now waiting for the verdict of Iran's Court for International Affairs. We will follow up the case in countries that maintain judicial cooperation with Iran. There, we will demand that U.S. assets be blocked and transferred as compensation to the families of the victims. This is to remind the criminal governments that their crimes will not go unanswered.
Israel has a history of targeted killing of Iranian nuclear scientists since 2010. While Tel Aviv has not commented on any of the assassinations, its footsteps can be traced in all of the incidents. In this video, recorded in 2018, ex-Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gives the game away.
Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, head of Project Abad, put it. Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
Less than 2 years after this comment, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was a key Iranian nuclear scientist, was assassinated. Over the years, different American and Israeli officials have spoken openly about, quote, taking down the nuts and bolts of Iran's nuclear industry. The plaintiffs here say the U.S. once tried to do so by killing Iranian nuclear scientists, and today by enforcing the so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran. But they say both measures have so far failed, and the West is now urging Iran to sit and talk about its nuclear program in Vienna to revive the 2015 nuclear pact.
plaintiffs here hope that their lawsuit against the U.S. will break the chain of Washington's targeting of the Iranian scientific community. But they say the underlying messages are even more important, as the case lays bare the U.S.'s double standards with regards to human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In many cities in France, anti-health pass protesters marched again in what has become a weekly protest. They do not agree with the mandatory measures the French government has established to obtain much more vaccinations. But the protest movement is weakening a bit. Important figures of the Yellow Vests want to re-engage with the original inquiries of the movement, more social justice and against the authoritarian policy of the government. They want to elaborate a political force that will be able to influence the 2022 presidential elections.
Today we are with the angry citizens against the health pass, but as the Yellow Vest movement, we continue demanding more social justice and less taxes and a participative democracy.
70% of the French have received two jabs of the anti-COVID vaccine. Due to the health pass that people have to show in almost every public places, the virus is soon to be under control, and life in France is slowly returning back to normal. The National Institute on Economic Studies, INSEE, announced that the French gross domestic product, GDP, will increase with more than 6% in 2021, after a fall last year of 10%. This is good news for the economy, except that workers' rights are deeply affected by the COVID crisis. More and more people lose their full-time contract, which is often transformed in variable working hours and a temporary contract, less paid and most of all offering less job security.
I am a volunteer worker. I see the misery. We distribute food. There is much more misery now, and more young people are in need.
During the lockdown, people with precarious contracts were affected the most. Today, the government of Macron is reforming the unemployment status. He makes the labor market very flexible. He takes advantage of this crisis to implement his antisocial policy.
French President Macron had once declared that an unemployed person just has to cross the street to find a job. For many people, this is only wishful thinking. The vaccination campaign is certainly successful in pushing back the COVID virus and putting the economy back on track. But the French population remains deeply divided about the mandatory health pass. Chris Den Hunt, Paris.
One of the major border crossing points between Pakistan and Afghanistan. For decades, on an average, every day, tens of thousands of people have been making back and forth movements on both sides of 2,700-kilometer-long porous border. After the return of the Taliban in Afghanistan, many Afghans are using Pakistan as a transit route to leave for Western destinations, given 70% unemployment in the neighboring country. However, weeks before and after the Taliban's takeover, the Western media have reported such routine traveling of Afghan citizens as being fresh influx of refugees into Pakistan, something the visiting UN High Commissioner have not denied to be the case.
The situation is better because there is no fighting. I have often been asked, is there big refugee movements? We have not seen big refugee movements, but of course, if the state collapses, we could see a lot of people trying to seek refuge in other countries. If the state ceases to function, this will provoke a crisis that is much bigger than humanitarian.
The UNHCR has reported nearly 500,000 internally displaced Afghan citizens inside Afghanistan. Their houses were bombarded by the US and the former Afghan Air Force during clashes with the Taliban in major urban centers like Kandahar, Herat, and Kunduz. Rest of Afghanistan largely fell to the Taliban after the US-trained Afghan army surrendered without any fighting.
We must make sure that